Well, so much for the atmosphere, the upper atmosphere of Mars. Let's talk now about the weather at the surface. Here is a picture taken by Viking Lander 1 of a meteorology boom, and this is the device from which all of those Martian weather reports came back. The boom itself is just sticking out to get the instruments reasonably far away from the lander. Here's the business end of it. This is one of the wind sensors. I'm sorry, it's one of the temperature sensors, and the wind sensors are around there, and they're a little bit hard to see in this picture. These are the so-called sand dunes of silt drifts in northeast of Viking Lander 1, and there you see the sky with the surprising brightness in it due to the atmospheric dust, and you notice that it is getting considerably darker as you get away from the horizon. I will now read the first weather report in history from another planet, which was sent back, of course, one day after Viking Lander 1 touched down, but which turned out to be almost the same every day thereafter for months. And that is very interesting and very exciting, because what it means is that bizarre though the Martian atmosphere is by Earth standards, it is also simpler than the Earth. Once you get over your amazement at the incredible phenomena that happened there, you can find out that there are relatively easy to understand explanations for those phenomena, and it is actually easier to understand weather on Mars than it is to understand weather on the Earth, which is just great. I've already mentioned that one of the values of doing this kind of study is to study other planets, is to allow you to get comparison data for your own planet, which is particularly nice if you can find one where it's not as complex as your own planet is. We've always known that, for example, the weather on Earth is affected severely by the oceans on the Earth. We've always known that it had a big effect on Earth meteorology, but we've never been very clear on what that effect is. Well, when you have that problem in science, what you like to do is a controlled experiment, where you remove the variable in question and see what happens. But the problem is, you can't do that on the Earth. You can't remove the oceans and see what it does to the weather. The environmentalists won't let you. So, you've got to go to another planet, which now for the first time in history can be done, and study what happens when there is a planet which is like the Earth in many respects, about the same axial tilt, about the same length of day, but which has no oceans. And it turns out that indeed the weather is simpler in ways that ought to give us an insight into what the effects of the oceans are in weather on the Earth. Okay, here it is in primarily the words in which Seymour Hess, the chief Viking meteorologist, read. I've interpolated a few remarks of my own, but here it goes. I'm not Sonny Elliott, but I'll do my poor best. At 1 p.m. Chrissy Standard Time, July 21st, 1976, the temperature on the west slope of the scenic Chrissy Basin was a brisk 22 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, rising toward an expected maximum later in the afternoon, which was, in fact, just about freezing. The minimum the previous night, reached just after dawn, was -122 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, and that is about 10 degrees below the all-time record low ever recorded on Earth, which of course was in the depths of the Antarctic winter, and I remind you that this was midsummer in the Martian tropics. Winds were light and from the east in late afternoon, changing to light and from the southwest after midnight. Maximum wind speed recorded was 15 miles per hour around dawn. Pressure was 0.23 inch of mercury, which is 0.75% of that sea level on Earth, and steady. Skies were hazy, but otherwise mostly clear. Now that, as it turns out, was a very typical Martian weather report for Chrissy Planitia in midsummer, that is, for the Viking Lander 1 site at the season where it touched down. And I'd like to go through each of the elements of a weather report. You notice there was one thing that was missing there, and that's humidity, which is the one standard element in a normal weather report which the landers are not capable of measuring. However, don't worry about that. We'll get it from the orbiters, which are, a little bit later on, I'll show you those data. But I'd like to go through the other standard elements one by one and show you what they are and also how they vary during the course of a Martian day, since the weather report that I just gave you was pretty much for one particular time, 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Here is a graph which shows the temperature variations during the course of a day. Local time down here means just what it says, the time of day. 0 hours is midnight, there is 6 a.m., there is 12 noon, there is 2 p.m., 4 p.m., 6 p.m., in other words, sunset is just about here. There, finally, is 24 hours, which is not midnight, because remember the Martian day is 24 hours and 39 minutes. And so here is midnight over there, and that edge of the graph is the same as the zero line just inside the left edge of the graph. The curve for Viking Lander 1 at Crissy is the black curve, and here are the temperatures. They have been labeled there incorrectly as being centigrade. In fact, there has been no such thing as centigrade temperature since 1948. Ever since then, we are supposed to have been calling it Celsius, and Sky and Telescope still hasn't gotten the word, and they're the people that I plagiarized this slide from, and so I'm stuck with it. These are degrees Celsius, and if you know your temperature scale, minus 40 Celsius is the same as minus 40 Fahrenheit, and the coldest that it got was somewhere around 120 to 130 below zero Fahrenheit. Superimposed on here for comparison is the temperature curve for China Lake, California, which is a typical desert region on the Earth. And that means a low humidity region, and that means comparable to Mars, at least as far as you can get on the Earth. Notice, however, that not only are the temperatures a great deal warmer, of course, on Earth, but also the range of temperatures during the day is not nearly as great. They have not given you the same size scale over here for Earth as they have over there for Mars. This one is blown up vertically by a factor of 2. 10 degrees is all that much on the Earth scale. It's only that much on the Mars scale. And yet, even so, we have more air than Mars does. Therefore, our temperature variations are less. China Lake, being in a desert, is a place where there is relatively little greenhouse effect, as little as you can get on Earth, because there is almost no water vapor, and therefore the greenhouse effect is due primarily to the other substance that causes it on Earth, namely carbon dioxide. And the carbon dioxide, of course, is the same percentage everywhere on the Earth, for reasons that I've told you about when I explained about the homosphere. However, the water vapor is the one thing that even in the homosphere varies a lot from place to place on the Earth. And so you have relative humidity as an important variable in Earth weather, and as it turns out, in Mars weather as well. In deserts, it can get quite cold at night. And you notice the coldest that it gets is just about at dawn. The fact that the sun, it's not at midnight, the fact that the sun is about to rise doesn't matter, because with that little greenhouse effect, the air cannot transmit the heat very effectively over the horizon. And so it isn't until the sun actually hits you where you are, not when it's hitting somebody else further to the east, that the temperature begins to rise again. It then rises very steeply and eventually hits a maximum somewhere after noon, but in a desert area, not a whole lot after noon. And in fact, on Mars, the lag is even less than it is on the Earth. And again, the reason for that lag is the blanketing effect caused by the greenhouse. It gets very cold at night on deserts on Earth, even in deserts which during the day get quite warm. That fact is directly responsible for the name of the rock and roll group Three Dog Night. I'm sure you never expected that at this lecture you would find out why Three Dog Night is called what it is, but you are about to find out. In the Australian desert, the Aborigines were very familiar with this, although they did not have a word in their language for greenhouse effect and therefore did not have the explanation. Nevertheless, they were very familiar with what happens on a planet where there's a relatively, or in a location where there's a relatively low greenhouse effect. They knew from bitter experience that it gets awfully cold at night in the Australian desert. Well, these were primitive peoples. They had not invented the Coleman heater to keep warm, and thus slept with dogs at night in order to keep warm. And they also had not invented the temperature scale, either Fahrenheit or Celsius, and therefore expressed temperatures crudely but expressively in terms of the number of dogs per person that it took to keep warm on a given night. And the coldest nights were three dog nights, and now you know. One of these days I'll meet somebody who knows those particular musicians, and they'll be able to tell me whether they themselves know the story about where their name came from. What do they know about the greenhouse effect? Well, on Mars, it would be just the same sort of thing, or even more so, because there is so very, very much less greenhouse, because so much less air. Even though it's entirely carbon dioxide, there's just so much less air to begin with. And so, not only are the temperatures, which any Martian light, for example, and of course that's one of the reasons this whole area is relevant, would have to survive, not only are those temperatures very low at night, 120, 130 below zero, but also there's an enormous range of temperatures during the course of every single Martian day, a range of more than 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, what that means is that either Martian life, if it lives on the surface, has had to evolve around that kind of problem, evolve defense mechanisms so that it can survive that kind of variation, or it has been clever enough to burrow down into the ground. And as I've already told you in one of my earlier lectures, if you go down on the ground on Mars just a very short distance, the soil is such a good insulator as a result of that thin air that there is no temperature variation at all during the course of the day or even during the course of the year. And so either Martian life is very clever about surviving temperature variations, or the place to look for it is not right at the surface where all of our searches have been so far, it is down underground. And you don't have to go very far underground, fortunately. I say fortunately because the Viking surface sampler cannot dig very deep. But what they're going to do, probably sometime in March, is dig a trench as deep as they can, and they're aiming for a foot, and then select samples for the biology experiment from the bottom of that trench and see what happens. There's another very interesting effect, which is shown on this graph. Here, again, we've got lander local time from 0 hours to 24 hours and a little bit beyond the end of a Martian day. Here we have temperatures in degrees Kelvin, just to keep you on your toes. Kelvin is absolute, and that means Celsius-sized degrees, but measured from absolute zero, the coldest it can ever possibly be, which is 456 below zero Fahrenheit, if I remember the number correctly, which I think I don't. Anyway, it's cold. And you measure from that instead of from an arbitrary zero having to do with the freezing point of water on Earth the way we do in Celsius. And so remember that the bottom of that curve is about 120 below zero Fahrenheit. And up there, the top, is just about 273 Kelvin, which is in fact zero Celsius, the freezing point of water. Now, these are temperatures measured by the orbiter. These are temperatures measured by the Viking landers, and that is 4 feet, 1.6 meter, above the ground, because that boom is not sitting right on the surface, it's hanging up in the air, as a good meteorology instrument should. These are temperatures, the dots and also the line, and this was a model at the time, however, subsequent measurements, this is quite an early graph, it was made very soon after the data began to come in. Subsequent measurements have shown that, in fact, the line is what it should be. This is the way the temperature varies during the course of a day at the ground. This is the way the temperature varies during the course of a day 4 feet above the ground. And I think you can see that during the night, they're the same, but in the morning, they begin to diverge, and by the afternoon, well, if you are 6 feet tall, extrapolate these data a little bit, and you were standing on Mars, your head would be a good 40 degrees Fahrenheit colder than your feet. And you see, the orbiter is measuring the temperature of the ground, because the way it measures temperatures is by measuring the intensity of that far ultraviolet radiation the ground is emitting. So it's seeing the ground, not a mere 4 feet above the ground, the way the lander is, the way the lander meteorology boom is. You'd think that wouldn't matter, but in fact it does. And the reason is that the air on Mars is so thin that when it is heated, when the ground is heated in the afternoon, the air simply cannot carry that heat away out into space. And so there's this phenomenal temperature gradient in the lower few feet of the Martian atmosphere. That is exactly the kind of situation that you need to produce a mirage. As you know, mirages are very common in desert areas on Earth, where a somewhat milder version of the same phenomenon happens. In fact, you've seen it. It sounds bizarre when I say your head will be 40 degrees colder than your feet, but think about it for a moment. Imagine a real hot parking lot on Earth, where, especially in asphalt, which is black and therefore really heated by the sun. Imagine standing out there on a blistering summer afternoon, if your imagination will really allow you to conceive of a blistering summer afternoon today, and imagine standing on your bare feet. You don't like the idea, do you? Would you mind if your head were bare? See what I mean? You get the same kind of phenomenon on Earth. Very, very much hotter down there on the ground than it is just a few feet up above, because the air can't carry the heat away fast enough. It's just that it's more extreme on Mars because the air is so much thinner. Well, what this means is that you cannot compare the orbiter data with the ground-based data directly. However, there are other temperature sensors on the Viking landers at various heights. These are for engineering purposes, but the meteorologists use them too. And so, in fact, we know quite a lot about these Martian temperatures. Well, what I started to say is you have to get mirages from that kind of thing, as you do in desert areas on the Earth for the same reason. Or as you do over an asphalt road on Earth on a hot summer day. Everybody's seen the wet road kind of mirage. It's called an inferior mirage. That's not a comment on its quality. It's a comment on the fact that it appears below the horizon, as opposed to the other, rarer kind of mirage, the superior mirage, which appears up above it. And the inferior mirage is caused by bending of light in air, which has a sharp temperature gradient from the bottom to the top, and therefore transmits light. Well, it acts as a lens. The temperature determines the density determines the optical properties of the atmosphere. And the superior mirage sort of thing, which as you know reflects the sky, that's why the road looks wet, it's the same color as the sky, and so it looks as though there were water there reflecting the sky, should happen on Mars also. And of course on Mars the sky is pink. Only Mars, therefore, ladies and gentlemen, can promise you pink mirages when you are perfectly sober. So far, however, we have not seen any in the lander pictures. And that's a little bit surprising. Now, part of the reason for that is something that I've already pointed out, namely that in each lander view, there is a near horizon taking up most of the field of view around the horizon, and then you have to look considerably behind these nearby ridges or whatever to see the true horizon, the far horizon in the background. The place where the mirage ought to appear is, in fact, largely hidden by those ridges. But still, there are some places where we can see the far horizon, and it's gotten to be a little bit surprising that, in fact, no mirages have appeared yet. I won't say it's the greatest crisis in our understanding of Martian conditions, but it is a little surprising, and I thought I'd pass it on to you for whatever it's worth. Now, here's something else which drives home how thin the Martian air is and how badly, how difficult it is for it to store heat. In other words, how little greenhouse you've really got. This is a map of a particular area on Mars, longitudes 37 degrees, 39 degrees, and so on, latitudes here. And these are temperature curves measured by the orbiter's infrared instrument. It's called the IRTM, Infrared Thermal Mapper. And they are degrees Celsius below what was predicted from certain theories that you don't have to worry about as being the temperature of this region. And what I want to show you is that over there it is very, 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 very cold. In fact, it is 70 degrees Fahrenheit colder than it ought to be and than it is over here. And the reason for that is very simply something that you can't see in this picture, that there's a cloud right over there casting a shadow on the ground. The shadow of a cloud is enough to cool the temperature 70 degrees. And that could happen in as short a time as 1/2 hour. Now, we have another complicated graph. See, I already showed you all the pretty pictures. That's in the geology part. Air is a lot harder to show pictures of. So we've got to show you graphs instead. And this is one where at least the temperatures are measured in Fahrenheit, which you understand. Down here are Earth and Mars dates both. And so let's try to explain these. And what we're going to do is separately for lander 1, which is blue, and lander 2, which is red, plot theoretical computed temperatures for the next Martian year or so, starting from the time where we landed, which was around there, and going ahead one Martian year. This is the maximum temperature that ought to be reached every day at the Viking Lander 1 site. The dotted line is the average temperature that ought to be reached every day. and the bottom line is the minimum temperature that ought to be reached every night. And then we have the same three lines for Lander 2, maximum, average, and minimum, during the course of a year. The dates down here are 1976 is that, 1977 is the part with the heavy bar there, and 1978, the first half is over there, and A and B were just my ways of indicating first half of the year and second half of the year. In other words, there's January 1st, 1977, there is July 1st, 1977, there's January 1st, 78. Okay? So that's the horizontal scale. The bottom scale down here is Mars date, and the length of this bar is just about one Martian year, and what I've indicated is the beginning of summer, the summer solstice, the beginning of autumn. These are in the northern hemisphere of Mars, where both Landers are. Of course, they're opposite in the two hemispheres. There is the beginning of winter. I'll explain T in a moment. There is the first day of spring, and there is the first day of summer again, and so here is exactly one Martian year, and I'll explain the A in a moment. Mars has seasons, like the Earth, and for exactly the same reason, namely that its axis is tilted with respect to its orbit. In fact, it's tilted by almost exactly the same amount, a little bit more than Earth, 25 degrees as compared to 23.5 degrees for the Earth. But Mars, unlike the Earth, has big variations in its temperature during the year as a result of variations in its distance from the Sun. The Earth's distance from the Sun varies hardly at all. We are always almost exactly the same distance. It's an almost perfectly circular orbit, which I can prove to you most graphically as you sit here in this Michigan winter by telling you that our closest to the Sun in the year 1977 was reached on January 4th. That was not exactly the hottest day of the year, was it? But on Mars, there is a lot of variation in distance. In fact, on the day when Mars is closest to the Sun, it receives, and that is called perihelion, and that's the reason for that P, it receives 40% more sunlight than it does on the average. And when it's farthest from the Sun, aphelion, indicated by a letter A, it receives 40% less than average. So even if there were no axial tilt at all, there would be big variations in the temperature during the Martian year. What gets really interesting is that both of those are going together. And there is no law that says they've got to be in phase with one another. Furthermore, let me point out that the seasons due to the variations in distance from the Sun, due to perihelion and aphelion, are the same for the entire planet. That is, the northern hemisphere is hottest at perihelion, and the southern hemisphere is hottest at perihelion. But the seasons due to the axial tilt are opposite in the two hemispheres. That is, the northern hemisphere is having summer when the southern hemisphere is having winter, and vice versa. It so happens that perihelion, the moment closest to the Sun, is just about, actually one Earth month before, the first day of winter in the northern hemisphere, which is the first day of summer in the southern hemisphere. And when you're farthest from the Sun, it's just before the beginning of summer in the north and winter in the south. So do you see how it's going to go? The seasons are going to be that as a male symbol, and what it represents is not what you always thought. It is the shield and spear of a warrior. And having told you that much, I will now infuriate all of the ladies in the audience who are at all, quote, liberated, end quote, by telling you that the female symbol was picked up perhaps by the same male chauvinist biologist, because it is the symbol for Venus, who was taken as the typical female, and that female symbol, which even the women's livers are using as a symbol with a clenched fist or an equal sign inside it, is a stylized representation of a hand mirror. From Mars, hence the end. The axial tilt season is trying to make it coldest at the same moment as the variation in distance season is trying to make it warmest. But in the southern hemisphere, that's the beginning of summer. And so both of them are trying to make it warmest. And over here, they're out of phase in the northern hemisphere and in phase in the southern hemisphere again. So the seasons are going to be much more severe in the southern hemisphere. It is going to be much warmer in summer and colder in winter. And indeed, you may have noticed that midsummer, even in the Martian tropics, Viking Lander 1 was measuring a temperature, and it's converted to ground temperature, by the way, so the hottest it's going to get, of just about freezing. And yet in the southern hemisphere, at the same season of the year, at the latitude where the sun is most directly overhead, not the equator, but down just about at the southern tropic of Mars, in fact, the Tropic of Capricorn, the temperature is 70 degrees Fahrenheit at the beginning of the southern hemisphere summer. You see? So this really is a significant effect. And it just so happens that at the latitude where Viking Lander 1 is at Crissy, the two effects practically cancel one another out. And so the temperatures are almost the same during the course of the entire Martian year, especially the minimum temperature that's reached every night. And to the extent that they are varying, it actually should have gotten warmer as the summer progressed and autumn began. The warmest that it gets turns out to be determined more by the fact that you're approaching perihelion than by the fact that you're moving away from summer. And so the hotter that it gets is somewhere around a few months from now, well into the autumn in the northern hemisphere, and then there's a secondary peak just after the beginning of spring in the northern hemisphere. Very, very different behavior from what you'd predict, but once you understand the physics, easy to understand. Lander 2 up in Utopia is a very different kind of story. If this is Utopia, well, I'd like to point out it gets to 190 below zero every night in the winter, and the hottest it ever gets at the beginning of winter, and that is their coldest, because you see there you're so much farther north that even the fact that you're at perihelion doesn't help you very much. The coldest that it ever gets is just under 100, I'm sorry, the warmest that it will get each day is just under 100 below zero Fahrenheit. In other words, only a few degrees warmer than the coldest that has ever been recorded in the history of meteorology on Earth. And every night, the temperature should get cold enough that the air freezes and falls on the ground around the lander, and then every morning it should evaporate again. However, remember that the lowest temperature is reached just after dawn. And so it should be possible by taking pictures in the very early morning to see the dry ice snow on the ground. Now the problem is that the lander was not really designed to survive this kind of temperature. And so they are about to begin in another few months SAM, which means safe something or other mission. What's the A stand for? I don't know. Anyway, SAM simply means that they are going to shut down the lander as much as possible and try to reserve the power as much as possible for just keeping the poor thing warm. And they are not going to use the surface sampler. They're not going to use the high-gain antenna, the one that communicates directly with the Earth and therefore has to be able to track the Earth across the sky. They're not going to use those because those have moving parts and they're afraid that they might get iced up and therefore damaged as they tried to move them. There is a big debate going on right now in the Viking engineering circles about whether or not they can try to take pictures, because the camera, you remember, has to move also. Remember how it scans around the horizon. They are definitely going to shut down at least one camera entirely, so they have at least one that survives through the winter. And what they're trying to decide now is whether it's worthwhile to declare the other camera expendable in order to get a few pictures, which can only be translated during transmitted during those moments when the orbiter is passing overhead. Because remember, we're not using the high-gain antenna to transmit directly with Earth. So, you know, it'll only be a few days that you'd be able to get it. And so the only way we would get pictures like that with the snow on the ground would be if they decide to use the camera at all, one of them, and therefore very likely destroy it by the end of the winter, and also if it so happens that there comes a day when an orbiter is passing right overhead just after dawn. And that might happen and it might not, since they're changing the orbits of the orbiters now and they don't know yet what changes they're making. We can't predict ahead of time and tell when that's going to be. That, by the way, is the other reason that they're so reluctant to change the orbit of the orbiter of Orbiter 2 back, having lowered it once. Then they've got to redo all the calculations about when they'll be able to do relay links through the orbiters. Links meaning transmissions back and forth to the Earth. And they've got so few people that, you know, a few months ago they could have done that just fine. It would have been all in the day's work. Now it's really a major fraction of their personnel resources. want to point out one more bizarre feature of this diagram, and that is that through the summer of 1976, it was warmer at Lander 2 site, 48 degrees north, than it was at Lander 1 site in the Martian tropics. And the reason for that, again, is some very simple physics, which is so simple that it doesn't apply to the Earth. You are farther north there, and that means that in summer, you are approaching the Arctic Circle. You're not at the Arctic Circle. The Arctic Circle is still north of you. But you are approaching the midnight sun condition. The Arctic Circle is defined as the farthest south that you ever have 24-hour daylight. The sun was in the sky on the first day of summer, 3 hours longer each day at the Lander 2 site than at the Lander 1 site. Therefore, of course it's warmer. You say, what do you mean, of course, on the first day of summer, where they're having midnight sun, is not the warmest place on Earth? Well, that's because Earth's meteorology is more complicated. On Mars, the physics is nice and simple and straightforward, and these theoretical predictions were, in fact, observed directly. It did not get quite as cold in the daytime at Lander 1 as it did at Lander 2, and every night, the temperatures at Lander 2 were actually a good deal warmer, and so in that respect, either I haven't drawn this diagram exactly, I copied it in some haste out of somebody else's work, or else more likely the theoretical calculations weren't 100% perfect, which they're not. They're known not to be. And by the way, where they are worst is for Lander 2, right here where we need them most, right around the beginning of winter. There are several variables that, it's too technical to explain what's going on, but there are several variables that are really important here that aren't important in most of the rest of the diagram, and so you may have to haul these either up or down by a considerable distance. And that considerable distance could make the difference between Lander 2 surviving or being destroyed by this coming Martian winter. Let's give you the dates, by the way. The summer solstice was on July 4th, the autumnal equinox was on January 4th, the perihelion will be on April 30th, the beginning of winter solstice, will be on May 30th, exactly one Earth month later. Okay, how are we? There is no way I'm going to have time to explain this diagram to you, and so I will simply tell you what it means. What it means is that the winds were absolutely repetitive from day to day during the course of the day for months. You could always count on the wind at 4 in the afternoon as being from the southeast. And it was always the same speed. Now, on Earth, you know perfectly well it's not that simple. So you see what I mean about the simplicity of Martian meteorology. And the reason for it was very simple and straightforward. Lander 1, you will recall, is perched about halfway down the west slope of a gigantic shallow bowl, several miles deep and several hundred miles wide, in the Martian surface, the Crissy Basin. And this big bowl, since it is deeper in the center, is therefore warmer in the center, especially in the afternoon, other things being equal, because there's more air there, and therefore there's more greenhouse effect there. And so, the air in the afternoon is warmed the same amount every day by the sun, and therefore the air in the bowl begins to expand and to rush up out of the bowl. And so you have winds going past you from the direction toward the center of the bowl. Okay, in other words, they're rushing up past you out of the bowl, and that is, for Viking Lander 1, just about the southeast. Remember how I told you the winds were from one direction one time, another direction another time, and it was, in fact, quite a cyclic variation. By the time night comes around, it gets cold. Well, you've got all this air that during the day has expanded up out of the bowl, and now it's turning around and it's flowing back in, and so you have winds coming from the opposite direction, namely from about the west of you. During the early morning, between around, about 2 a.m. and sunrise, this little funny loop in the diagram represents that the winds went through a series of oscillations. They would shift, they'd swing back and forth the direction that they were coming from. And even those oscillations, although they did not occur every morning, when they did occur, repeated themselves almost exactly. And so even the fine details of the paths by which the air is flowing back down into the basin are the same from day to day. The reason for the oscillation is not understood, but there is one theory which is probably right, and it's really kind of incredible. Here you've got the Crissy Basin, which is this big bowl, and it's full of fluid. Therefore, it is rather like a bathtub full of water. If something, some energy, which doesn't have to be very great, gets that water moving back and forth just a little bit, you know that you can get rather strong oscillations in the water of a bathtub by simply pushing it hard enough. Just give it one gentle little tug once per cycle, and back and forth it'll start sloshing. We think that this is exactly the same thing that we're seeing in the early Martian morning. That it is literally air sloshing back and forth in the Crissy Basin as though in a giant bathtub. Calculations as to the period and amount of the oscillations that ought to be expected, theoretical calculations, agree pretty well with what is observed. At Lander 2, the winds were different, and the reason for that is that Lander 2 is out on the middle of an open plain, the middle of Vastitas Borealis, Utopia Planitia. It is not sitting on the side of a basin, and therefore there is nothing local which determines its meteorology in the same way as there is at the Lander 1 site. Its meteorology is determined by global effects. And so once again, the winds are perfectly regular every day. Consider, the hottest place on the planet at any given moment is going to be the place directly underneath the sun, the place as seen from which the sun is directly overhead. If that's the hottest place, the air there will be expanded, and winds will tend to rush away from that place. But as the planet rotates, where that place is on the planet moves across the planet from east to west. So, in the early morning, here you are way up at latitude 48 degrees north now. In the early morning, the place where the sun is hottest, and therefore where the winds are coming from, is way over to the southeast of you from somewhere, and that's where your winds are coming from. At high, completely around during the course of the night, and they come from due north, and then from the east, and finally, by sunrise the following morning, or thereabouts, they're coming from the southeast again. This one I'm going to skip over beyond saying the fact that the pressure varied during the course of the day for exactly the same sort of reason. That is, there's more air pressure when it's hotter because the sun is higher in the sky, and there's less air pressure because it's colder. And on top of that effect, which is represented by this single daily curve like so, this is pressure here, variations in millibars from the average pressure during the course of the day, and this is our old friend local Lander time down here. In addition to that, you have a tide in the atmosphere produced by the sun, a gravitational tide. And that in this curve here, the combination of the two curves acting together give you the observed pressure curve, which is quite regular every day and is represented by this line. This particular one is Lander 2. Something that's even easier to understand, and I think even neater, however, is this diagram. Sol is a made-up word to mean a Martian day, 24 hours, 39 minutes, as opposed to an Earth day, and they used the word sol so that you wouldn't get confused by what kind of day they meant. Sol zero was, by definition, the day that the lander touched down, and the first complete day was on the surface was Sol 1, and the next day was Sol 2, and so forth, so on, the next Martian day. And so here are Sols 2, 4, 6, 8, and so on, and you can see we've got the first 20 days worth of data from, as it happens, Viking Lander 1. And what we have plotted for those 20 days is the average barometric pressure in millibars during that day. And this bar here tells you the error of a single determination of that average pressure. Well, what I think you can see is that every day, on the average, the pressure fell. It got less and less and less and less. And Seymour has said that on Earth, behavior like that, pressure falling every day, would mean there was a storm coming, but he was not about to claim that's what it meant on Mars. And as a matter of fact, it turned out very quickly that wasn't what it meant on Mars, because it continued to fall every day for several months. Hess pointed out that if this behavior continued, in another 470 days, Mars would have no air whatever. However, he didn't think that air, that behavior was going to continue. Do you know what's doing it? 4,000 miles away. No, it was not an instrumental failure. And in fact, they thought about that because most pressure measuring devices involve a comparison pressure, a standard pressure, which they've got to use to compare the pressure they're measuring with. And if that comparison pressure had some sort of soil leak, you would get exactly this kind of effect. But they were able to satisfy themselves that in fact it was not this, and after we had a second lander down, we began to see the same behavior. It leveled off toward the end of September and has now disappeared entirely. What was happening was very simply that 4,000 miles away, in the other hemisphere, around the South Pole, it was the beginning of winter, and the air was freezing and falling on the ground. The northern hemisphere polar cap had already finished evaporating, and so every day there was a little bit less air on Mars than there was the day before. And that was affecting Viking Lander 1 in the tropics in the other hemisphere on the opposite side of the planet. It's as though your local meteorologist here in the Detroit area were predicting the pressure not on the basis of what was going on in Detroit or even in North America, but on the basis of what was happening in Antarctica. This is an effect which is global and is dominating the pressure not only there but everywhere on the planet. Now, speaking of the polar cap, there's been a lot of misunderstanding about something, which, especially in the news media, which I would like to point out to you. These are two pictures of the southern hemisphere polar cap taken in Martian winter in Earth year 1969 by Mariner 7, and this section here shown in Martian summer in Earth year 1971 by Mariner 9, and in both cases the South Pole is that dot. Please note that there is more to the polar cap than you're seeing in this picture. There is continuous 24-hour a day, in fact 24-hour, 39-minute a day, darkness in this portion here. And if it were lighted up all the way around, you would see polar cap all the way over here. The point is, nevertheless, I think it's clear that the polar cap is a lot bigger in the winter than it is in the summer. Now, we have known ever since Mariner 7 in 1969 that the winter polar caps are made of frozen carbon dioxide, and that it is a case, as I've said so many times in these lectures, of the air freezing solid and falling on the ground. When Mariner 9 got there, it was at the very end of the winter, and there was still a little bit of the winter polar cap left. It was shrinking rapidly, but it was still there, and the scientists were really looking forward to watching it shrink and finally disappear entirely. What happened instead was it shrank and it shrank and it shrank until it got down to about the size that you're seeing there, and then it simply stopped. And that thing that you see there remained through the entire summer virtually unchanged. Well, it was pretty obvious from this behavior that what was happening was the shrinking carbon dioxide polar cap had in fact gone away entirely and had uncovered a little residual polar cap made of some different substance which had a different freezing point and could remain solid even during the Martian summer. And that's not terribly strange. Let me point out that Martian summertime temperatures at the pole are far colder than the coldest it ever gets in winter in the poles on Earth. So it will be well below the freezing point of water, and the obvious suggestion for this residual polar cap, which you see only during the spring and summer, is that it was made of a different substance, namely frozen water. That, you see, was 99% certain from Mariner 9, 5 years ago. However, we didn't have actual proof that it was water that this thing was made of and not something else. And we have obtained that proof from the Viking landers. This constitutes the proof, and again, since we're running late, I'm not going to try to describe the picture to you. Believe me, this constitutes part of the proof. I mean, this by itself would be good proof. Basically, these are temperature measurements over the polar cap, and they are far over the residual polar cap, and this is the northern residual polar cap, but the southern is presumably the same thing, and these temperatures are far too hot for any of it to be frozen carbon dioxide. It's fine for it to be frozen water, and here we have measurements by the other instrument on the Viking orbiters. Let's see, orbiter 1 in this part and orbiter 2 in the rest of it. And this is the instrument which measures the amount of water vapor in the Martian atmosphere. And you can see the water vapor is increasing very sharply as you go north. Now, this is latitude. This is the amount of water vapor. It doesn't matter what the units are. The point
atmosphere, and you can see the water vapor is increasing very, very sharply as you go north. Now, this is latitude, this is the amount of water vapor, it doesn't matter what the units are, the point is, this is very little, and this is, by Martian standards, a lot, by Earth standards, very, very little. And this is latitude from the South Pole, going north, 60 degrees south, 30 degrees south, to the equator, to 30 degrees north, to 60 degrees north, to the North Pole of Mars. And I think you can see that this, of course, was the pole that was having summer, this was the pole that was having winter. I think you can see in the winter, there's practically no water vapor in the Martian atmosphere, but as you get into summer, especially up near the polar regions, you have lots and lots of humidity in the air, and the humidity is greatest at the very edge of the residual polar cap, which is, in fact, its latitude right here. So it seems pretty obvious that the water vapor in the Martian air is coming from that polar cap, and the polar cap is therefore made of frozen water and not of frozen carbon dioxide, but that is the residual polar cap. That says nothing at all about the winter polar cap, the big one, which extends in the winter from the pole to about the same latitude as southeastern Michigan is here on the Earth, or a little bit further south. All right. These data were picked up by the news media, and a few months ago, a few weeks ago, in fact, you all saw the report. Viking has shown that the polar caps of Mars are made of frozen water and not of frozen carbon dioxide, as had been believed. So there's just another example of the reporters getting something completely confused because they didn't know enough about Mars. What this was that the residual polar cap is made of frozen water, and I don't see why such a big fuss was made about that, because it was almost certain from the Mariner 9 photographs. You know, it was an interesting confirmation of Mariner 9 data, it was worth a footnote in a news story somewhere, but it was hardly one of the big Viking discoveries. However, this graph does give me an opportunity to illustrate another bizarre feature of Martian meteorology, and that is that it gets more humid toward the pole, not toward the equator, as on Earth. And the reason for that is there are no oceans on Mars. On Earth, the major reservoir of the substance water, whether solid, liquid, or gas, is the oceans, where it happens to be a liquid. And so the major source of water vapor for the air is the oceans. And the more of it, you can have more of it, the hotter the oceans are. And so, of course, the humidity is greatest down at the equator. On Mars, it's just the opposite. There are no oceans. The major source of the substance water is the polar cap, the summer polar cap, the residual polar cap, where the water is in the frozen state, and so it evaporates and releases vapor into the air, and you get most humid up near the poles. That whole thing about humidity is very important in connection with the question of whether life can exist on Mars, and that was the significance of the discovery of ground fog on Mars by the Viking orbiters. Here's a picture of the same area of Mars. Those two craters are these two craters, and here is one of the great water carved channels, and there you see it again. These two pictures were taken only half an hour apart by Viking Orbiter 1. This was taken just after sunrise, when the ground down here was still bitterly cold, and apparently what had happened was most of the humidity, which you saw in that last slide, that had existed there during the day, had frozen out and sunk into the ground a little bit. And it still wasn't warm enough that ice was being evaporated again. Remember, it wouldn't melt on Mars, it would evaporate. But now, half an hour later, the sunlight has heated it up enough that it does evaporate, and the low areas, the channel and the insides of some of the craters, as shown by arrows, are full fog. That fog has come up out of the ground, and it's going to stay there during the course of the day, and then at night it's going to fall back down into the ground again. So every day you have a cycling of water between the surface and the atmosphere of Mars. And that, coupled with the Viking orbiter observations that what little water vapor Mars has in its atmosphere is almost exclusively concentrated in the lowest mile or so of the air and not spread uniformly throughout the atmosphere, that's the one respect. See, water vapor, again, just as on Earth, is the one respect in which the homosphere isn't a homosphere, in which the homosphere isn't completely the same relative percentages of substances all the way through. That means that the tiny amount of water vapor in the Martian atmosphere is concentrated down towards the surface where, presumably, hypothetical living things could get at it. And so Mars is not quite as dry a desert from the point of view of life as you might think by looking at the very tiny amounts of water, which is all that it has, water vapor, which is all that it has in its air. The humidity on Mars can actually get up to 100%. Or else, how would you have these fogs? And you get 100% all the time, all through the summer, around the residual polar cap. And so that second fact particularly means that it may very well be that the best place to look for life on Mars is up around the polar caps, despite the enormously cold temperatures. So maybe we've landed in the wrong places. Well, you know, that's the problem. You land in two places on the surface of a planet that you don't know anything about. You can't expect to study the entire planet from those two places. And maybe the next landing should be a good deal farther towards one or the other of the polar caps. Well, there is very much more to say about Martian atmosphere, but there is not much more time to say it in, and so I'm going to skip through a number of pictures. That last one was intended to tell you about the North Polar Hood, and I already did, as it turned out, and this one was intended to tell you about the great global dust storms, but I have described those a little bit before. What happens is that every Martian year, just after perihelion, apparently something about the extra heat has triggers some instability in the Martian atmosphere and starts winds going. The winds stir up dust from the Martian surface. That dust absorbs heat from the sun and makes the atmosphere still hotter. That stirs up still more winds and so on, and that can chain reaction until much or even all of the planet is covered with winds of 400 and 500 miles an hour, which cover the planet, as they did here, as photographed by Mariner 9 in 1971, cover the entire planet, the entire surface of a globe half the size of Earth, with roiling veils of dust 30 miles high into the atmosphere. And that went on for 4 Earth months, and it was only then that the dust began to settle and we could finally begin to see something of the surface. And this picture is showing you circulation within the dust. The contrast in this picture has been enormously increased. It's like turning the contrast knob on your television set up all the way and then a factor of 100 beyond that. These are the 4 great volcanoes in the Tharsis region, Olympus Mons and the 3 Tharsis Montes. This is how they were discovered. And you can see the air circulation around those, particularly south of Arcia Mons, where you have these tails in the wind as a result of the disturbance set up in the dust. That dust was 30 miles high in the atmosphere, but the mountain itself was 15 miles high. The bulk of the dust was below 30 miles. And you could see the top of the mountains as these dark spots here, which if the contrast weren't so enhanced, you would be able to see details of the summits of the mountains, and that's how they were discovered. Originally, they were not given the nice fancy names that they have now. This one was called Nyx Olympica after the region of Mars where it was seen, and it's now called Olympus Mons. And these three, they didn't have any obvious regions associated with them, and so the scientists thought very hard about new names to give them up. And consulted the appropriate Greek and Latin roots and so forth, and eventually decided to call them North Spot, Middle Spot, and South Spot. Well, they've now got a nice name of their own, so not to worry about that. Still, 5 years after that last really major global dust storm, still the dust is settled. About 5% of it is still left in the air, and there is some newer dust that has been stirred up by more recent winds since, and that is what produces those incredible pink skies. This is the first version of that first color photograph from Mars that was released. This is the historic error, the one with the blue Earth-like sky, and this is the correct version down here, and I thought you might like to see them side by side. And finally, this is what the Martian air is made of as compared with the atmosphere on Earth. 95% of the air on Mars is carbon dioxide, which makes up only 0.3% of the air on Earth. Most of our air, 78%, is nitrogen, which is 2.7% on Mars. Now that's not much, but nitrogen was the last of the list of substances known to be necessary for all life on Earth that were not previously known to be present in the atmosphere on Mars. Because as I've told you, nitrogen is very hard to detect from the outside. So the discovery of nitrogen was the final thing that cleared the way for the proposition that Mars is a suitable environment for life. In other words, if it turns out there is no life there, that finding will be almost as important and teach us almost as much about the nature of life on Earth and why there is life on Earth as if there is life on Mars. Because we will have to find out why this planet, which is suitable for life, did not develop. Nobody would be able to weasel out, as you could for the moon, for example, which to no one's surprise had no life on it, by saying, well, you would expect life, the environment is not suitable. The environment is suitable, and there's the proof. Argon makes up the third most abundant material in the Earth's atmosphere, is almost 1%. It's even more than that on Mars, 1.6%. And that turns out to have some very important implications, which I haven't got the time to go into. Finally, oxygen is, from photosynthesis, of course, on Earth, 21%, almost a fifth of, over a fifth of the atmosphere. On Mars, there is a tiny amount of it, but don't get excited about that number. That does not indicate photosynthesis. All of that can be accounted for by photodissociation, that is, the breakup by ultraviolet light of water molecules, and we know that there are small quantities of water vapor in the Martian atmosphere. Okay, once again, there's much more to say, but not enough time to say it, and I'm afraid I'm not going to have time to explain to you why a planet's atmosphere ought to be this way and not this way, but let me tell you the bottom line of that, which is that it is Mars that is the normal one and the Earth that is the freak with respect to these percentages. If it were not for a whole series of rather unlikely coincidences in the history of the Earth, including the development of life on this planet, Earth would have an atmosphere about 100 times as dense as it actually does, and that atmosphere would be almost entirely carbon dioxide. And any of you who know about Venus will recognize that description, because that's exactly the way Venus is. Venus is the only planet in the solar system that is almost exactly the same size and weight as the Earth. Therefore, you expect it to be a twin of the Earth. It very clearly is not, and it turns out that it is Venus and not the Earth that is the normal one, and that had things been very, very slightly different, we would have been like Venus. I shouldn't say we'd have had 100 times as much air as we do, we'd have had 300 times as much. The rest of it would have been the water, which at present is a liquid. But with the greenhouse effect that carbon dioxide would have produced, the water too would have been a gas. And that would have been the dominant constituent of the Earth's air. For Venus, you don't have all that water for reasons I haven't got time to go into. In fact, for reasons that are not too well understood, but I haven't got time to go into the theory. So, okay, on that note, I will thank you once again for your attention and invite you back for the final two lectures, which are on the findings of the Viking biology instruments. And I'll warn you right now, we do not know if there's life on Mars, so all I can do is bring you up to the same level of confusion and ignorance as enjoyed by the experts in the field. Thank you very much. And of course, anybody who has any questions is most welcome to stay around and ask them.
What's the name of the book?
The Cosmic Connection.
How can you relate the temperature on Mars versus the evolution of the temperature on Earth? Anything like the similar to our ice age or anything?
That is a very interesting question. Okay, question is there any phenomenon on Mars that is similar to the ice ages on the Earth? And of course, the obvious thing you think of is the climatic oscillations expressed in the water car channels. It would be very nice if we knew the answer to that, and we just don't. Because we haven't got good ages for the channels yet. See? And so we can't correlate the relative timescale. You gotta remember, we have no Mars rocks on Earth. Therefore, we have no date, absolute dates, for Martian features. Absolute date means it's so-and-so many billion years old, as opposed to a relative date, which means this is older than that. That you can see from orbit. You know, if it's covered with meteorite craters and badly eroded, it's old, but how old? See? And what they're trying to do, since we do have absolute dates now for the moon, and can therefore calibrate the relative ages that you get from things like numbers of craters, what they're trying to do is apply that same kind of thing with appropriate corrections for the fact that Mars is closer to the asteroid belt and so forth, to Mars and get absolute dates for Mars, and of course the problem is nobody agrees on what the appropriate corrections are. So maybe they'll be able to do that and maybe they won't. And my guess is, considering the range of dates that people came up with for the moon on the basis of crater count before we had any rocks back, now of course, you know, then we found out the truth for the moon, so we ought to be better off for Mars, but still, my guess is when we get the real dates, we're going to be very surprised, or most of them are going to be very surprised, and there'll be somebody who'll be able to pound his chest and say, I guess right, see, and, you know, that's the way it goes. Yeah. Oh, thank you very much.
You were in California, I think.
Okay, yes, on August 15th, I was in California. All right, good. Thank you very much. Yeah?
Is there a launch date for Mariner Jupiter Saturn?
Yes. Question is, launch dates for Mariner Jupiter Saturn? Of course, there is a launch window, and if they can't make it on the first date, they'll try it later. But the nominal dates at the moment, which is to say the earliest of each of the launch windows, are August 20th of this year for Mariner 11, and September, boy, 3rd or 4th, I think. Let me look that up. They're only, they're less than 2 weeks apart, and if you wanted to see one, you could probably stay down there and see both, assuming that they didn't put them off. Of course, the Vikings weren't very far apart when they started out either. Let me see here. Mariner 12 is scheduled for September 1st at 8:50 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, and the August 20th launch for Mariner 11 is scheduled for 10:40 a.m. Eastern Daylight. And those time constraints would be very tight. The launches would be surely within an hour or two, and probably less than that at those times. But the day can be changed. There's a narrow time window on each day. I think you had your hand up before anybody. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just wondering, to what do they attribute atmospheric differences in, say, the Earth and Mars?
Yeah. To what do they attribute the atmospheric differences between the Earth and Mars? See, the problem is that's another whole lecture, which would have been about half an hour, another whole part of the lecture, and that was the section which was going to follow this. I'm sorry. You know, maybe someday I can come back and tell you the whole story. Yeah.
With the rarefied atmosphere of Mars, is there any possibility of seeing what we know on Earth as the Northern Lights?
Any possibility of an aurora on Mars? The aurora on Earth is produced in a very, very rarefied atmosphere, 60 to as much as 250 or more miles above your head. And that's very, very thin, far thinner than you get near the surface on Mars. However, for an aurora, you also need a good strong magnetic field to funnel the charged particles, well, to produce a Van Allen radiation belt and to funnel the radiation belt particles into the atmosphere, and Mars doesn't have it. So the answer is no. Yeah?
You can melt the residual ice cap into one body of water, how large would it be?
If you could melt the residual ice cap into one body of water, how large would it be? I've seen numbers on that, and it's not at all impressive. I don't think it would fill one of our great lakes, but I don't remember the exact number. It's not at all very much. We don't know, of course. We are going to be able to measure how deep the snow is in the ice caps, because you can see the depths of craters that are just barely buried, and that gives you the depth. However, what we don't know is how much permafrost there is on Mars, both under the residual ice cap and over the entire planet. As I pointed out to you in an earlier lecture, everywhere on the planet, even the equator, the temperature underground is below the freezing point of water. So there may be very large amounts of water stored on Mars in the form of permafrost, and that is probably what you'd want for the major body. Of course, you realize, or maybe you don't, and so I'll point it out to everybody just in case you don't realize it. You said melt, and of course, that's to put it in Earth terms because you're more familiar with liquid water, but it wouldn't melt, it would evaporate. So if you imagine trying to form a lake on Mars, it would evaporate about as rapidly as water on the surface of a frying pan, which was heated to above the boiling point of water on the stove, because the air is just so dry, just suck it up. The North Polar region would be the one exception to that. You might be able to have some liquid water lying around the surface there if it weren't so darn cold. So you can't.
You mentioned the series broadcast.
Oh, well, they're on National Public Radio, and they're whenever I have something to say and they want me to say it. And the second, you know, obviously is their choice, but they have been very, very good about letting me say whatever I wanted to. So really, it's a matter of whenever I have something to send them. The next one, in fact, will be tomorrow, and it'll be some recent Viking findings. But the difficulty is it's a 90-minute nightly news program, and, you know, I really hesitate to suggest to anybody that you listen to an entire hour and a half program every single night just to catch me for 4 or 5 minutes sometimes. You know, I'm certainly not on every night. I will be on tomorrow night, but I don't know when during the program. The program is called All Things Considered, and it's broadcast on 4 stations, which you can pick up here, or maybe even a 5th, depending on whether you can get WEMU in Ypsilanti. But you can certainly get WDET in Detroit, You can get WULM in Ann Arbor. You can get WGTE in Toledo. And you may, depending on how good your radio is, even be able to get WKAR in East Lansing. We can get it from Ann Arbor just fine, but of course you're further east. If you want to hear, say you listen every day anyway, and that's, you know, I would not suggest that unless you're listening to the rest of the program that you listen to it just for me. If you do listen every day, though, and you are interested enough that you'd like to hear mine, you know, as long as you're listening, you will hear a considerably higher percentage of mine. In fact, you'll hear 100% if you listen every night on WGTE in Toledo or WKAR in East Lansing, if you can get it, rather than WULM or WDET. And the reason for that is that, for technical reasons having to do with the way the program is put together, very often, by no means always, I wish there were a way to predict when I was going to be on, but very often I end up being on at 5:30 exactly. And UOM and DET both split away from the network at 5:30 and go to their own local news, and so they don't broadcast. Now, the number of stations in the 200-plus station NPR network that does that is very small. It's only about 15 stations. So they don't worry about rebuilding the program, you know, just for that. I mean, I've told them, hey, every time you do this to me, everybody hears me all across the country except my own hometown, you know. And they sympathize with my problem, but it turns out there are good reasons for putting me on at 5:30. They have to do with the way the program is put together. And they just can't rebuild the whole program for 15 stations. But what it comes down to is if you listen to GTE, you'll hear me more often. WGTE is all these stations except DET in Detroit are down at the low frequency end of the FM dial, the educational ghetto. WDTE in Detroit, which does break away at 5:30, is 101.9 megahertz. These are all FM. And Ohio, Toledo, WGTE is 91.3 megahertz. And GTE is the one that I'd recommend. It's a little harder to pick up here in Detroit than DET, but unless you live in a bad area, you should be able to get it.
We listened to you last summer.
Ah.
Not all things considered.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed the fortune.
Well, good. Okay, well, it's the same thing. Same time, same station. And the programs are on at 5 o'clock on all four of those stations every weeknight. On Saturdays and Sundays, they're half-hour programs, and they're on at different times. Oh, yeah. And I'm very, very often on Saturdays and Sundays. For reasons that have mostly to do with my schedule. So I've noticed a lot of people say, gee, I listened to you all the time last summer, and I say, but I'm still on. And part of the reason they don't realize that is this 5:30 thing, and part of it is that very often I'm on Saturdays and Sundays. I was on last Saturday, I think it was. It was either Saturday or Sunday. And the programs are broadcast in different times, different stations, then. WULM broadcasts them, and here you don't have to worry about the 5:30 thing. It's only a half-hour program. There's no breakaway. UOM broadcasts them at 6 o'clock on Saturdays and at 8 p.m. on Sundays. And the other stations, I just don't know. So, that's the story. Okay, other questions? You had a question.
It's not coming.
Okay. Yeah.
Taking a free mirror, they used to differentiate between two types of clouds, white clouds and yellow clouds.
Right.
Whatever became of that after the...
Okay, the white clouds are clouds, the yellow clouds are the dust storms. And you also heard about a third kind sometime, the blue clouds. Those are the same as the white clouds, and in fact, that was known in those days. The blue clouds are the clouds that showed up even in the blue pictures. They weren't literally blue. You saw them in the blue pictures, and you saw no other detail in the blue pictures. And they turn out to be the same as the white clouds. Now, there are two kinds of clouds on Mars, though, frozen carbon dioxide and frozen water. Mars is the only planet we know where there are two different substances in the atmosphere that can form clouds and that can precipitate. And it's the only planet we know where the major constituent of the atmosphere is one of the substances that can precipitate. Comparison with Earth, where the greenhouse is due to trace constituents. And I told you about Three Dog Night. Yeah?
You've shown us a number of pictures and graphs.
Most of those graphs I took either I directly copied them, and I have copying equipment, obviously. I directly copied them, or I redrew them myself with nothing more than felt-tip marker from the three special issues of Science magazine that have been almost entirely devoted to Viking findings.
and there was one of those in August, one in October, and one in December. I don't remember the exact dates, but if you go to a library and look through back issues of Science Magazine, you'll find them. That is the source for Viking findings to this point. However, it is technical. But you can certainly find the graphs in there. The graphs of temperature tend to be in degrees Kelvin, you know, and I thought it would be humane to render them into Fahrenheit and that kind of thing, and so I redrew some of them. Yeah?
Does a very thin atmosphere on Mars explained by the smaller gravitational field, or could it come out to more air
It depends. The question is the very thin atmosphere on Mars explained entirely by the small gravitational field? That depends on the gas. If you had 100 times as much carbon dioxide on Mars, you know, if you could just put it up there, it would stay as well as the carbon dioxide that's there now. You know, it doesn't weigh any more, it doesn't weigh any less. So the atmosphere will determine what gases a planet is capable of keeping. Thus, Jupiter has mostly hydrogen in its atmosphere. Earth and Mars have none because neither of us has a gravity great enough to hold them. Oh, we have tiny amounts, which are being, which are in the process of escaping from the planet at any given moment and are due to the breakup of water molecules by ultraviolet, but, you know, essentially no hydrogen. And so I suppose if I tried hard enough, I might be able to think of some gas which the Earth can hold and Mars can't. But actually, as it turns out, there are none of the common ones, none of the major constituents of the two atmospheres, which even Mars can't hold. So the real reason that Mars has less atmosphere is there has been a lot of loss into space, not simply by escape because the gravity couldn't hold it, but by more complex mechanisms, which are another whole long lecture in itself, probably half an hour to three quarters of an hour or more, and which also I would have talked about tonight if I'd had time. The biggest mistake that I made was telling Granbrook 5 lectures. There should have been 6, there should have been 2 for the atmosphere. I just didn't realize. I had no idea there was so much material to talk about in the atmosphere, so I apologize, you know. Having to leave all this stuff out is my fault, but you know, it's the situation we've got, and that one is a long story. There are mechanisms by which materials can escape from the Martian atmosphere, and those are very interesting mechanisms because they affect different gases and even different isotopes of the same gas, different amounts. Therefore, you can use things like the amounts of the relative amounts of the two isotopes of nitrogen that are now left in the current Martian atmosphere to figure out how much of one must have escaped versus how much of the other must have escaped, and calculate that back to the beginning of Mars's history and find that Mars must have indeed produced a great deal more atmosphere than you see around it now. Some of it has escaped into space, not, as I say, by simple escaping from gravity, but by other things that are more complicated, and some of it has undoubtedly, a lot of it, the bulk of the water vapor and the bulk of the carbon dioxide are undoubtedly trapped on the planet, either frozen, particularly with the water, or combined chemically with rocks, or both. And they're still working on that. There's a big problem, big discrepancy. There are certain data which seem to indicate that Mars should have produced so much water vapor that if most of it is still on the planet, even allowing for the escape rate of water that we see and observing the amount of oxygen and the amount of hydrogen that are being lost by Mars, still most of it should be on the planet. And if you assume that it's in the form of permafrost, it seems hard to imagine how else it would be stored, and you make any reasonable assumption about the ratio of ice soil in the permafrost, you end up with a layer of soil miles thick simply to be able to hold the water. And there's no other evidence that there are layers of soil miles in thickness on much of Mars. For example, practically the whole depth of Pallas Marineris would have to be soil. Maybe you're allowed an occasional lava flow in between, but most of it's got to be soil. And that, the geologist just will not buy. So it's an interesting question, and it's by no means a question with an easy or obvious answer, but the subtle answers can tell us a lot about the history of Mars' atmosphere. More, in fact, than we can learn about the atmosphere and the Earth, where these escape mechanisms don't operate for various reasons. Yeah?
Why is there more argon?
There is not more argon in Mars' atmosphere than Earth. The percentage is bigger. That's a very different statement. The reason the percentages are different is that, well, I mean, that's the whole story about the origin of a planet's atmosphere. But remember that a percentage reflects not only the amount of the gas, but also the amount of all the other gases. And so the reason that argon is a relatively low percentage of the Earth's atmosphere is in part the fact that oxygen is a high percentage of the Earth's atmosphere, and you don't have that to worry about on Mars. And so when you calculate, you know, say it was the same amount of argon on both planets, you'd end up with a smaller percentage on Earth, just because you've got to count that oxygen into the total 100% on Earth, and you don't on Mars. It's easy to lose track of that and start taking those percentages more seriously than they deserve to be taken. The only way that they are important is to compare them with each other on a given planet and say, all right, why does Mars have X times as many carbon dioxide as nitrogen, or X times as many carbon dioxide as argon, or something like that? Okay, if you want to compare, here's one. If you want to compare Mars with Earth most directly, take the percentage of carbon dioxide and the percentage of argon and figure out how much more CO2 than argon there is on both planets. Okay, not the total percentages, but just how much more CO2 than argon. And then you get a direct comparison, because the Earth has lost practically all of its carbon dioxide, and practically none of its argon. Mars has lost argon, but not carbon dioxide. I'm sorry. Take that back. It's lost both. Okay, so your comparison is not going to be simple. It's an interesting story. It's also another whole lecture. Yeah?
You stated that the atmosphere on Venus was more normal, so to say, than the atmosphere on Earth. Is that a solar system, or is that any planetary system?
It's in the terrestrial planets of our solar system. The extent to which this would also be true of other solar systems is one of the many things we just don't know. We don't know if there are other solar systems. And if there are, we don't know the extent to which their formation was similar to the way our solar system formed, which is the thing that I'd have to know to be able to answer that question. So what I was doing was comparing, I was talking about, without explaining what I was saying, the origins of the atmospheres of the terrestrial planets, which are the type of planets that Earth and Venus and Mars are, as compared to even a different kind of planet that we have in our own solar system, the Jovian planets, Jupiter, Saturn, and so on, where there's a very different story about the origin of their atmospheres. In fact, a totally different story. And so what's normal for Venus isn't normal for Jupiter. But what's normal for Venus is normal for the Earth, and we aren't that way. That's another whole lecture, which in fact I already gave. That was the outer planets thing. Terrestrial planets are mostly solid, and Jovian planets are mostly hydrogen and helium. That's the easiest way to differentiate. And the reason is that their gravity was different, and Jupiter was able to hold the hydrogen and helium, and Earth wasn't. And most of the universe is hydrogen and helium. So if you've got enough gravity to hold it, you're going to be mostly hydrogen and helium. Okay. Except that that's oversimplifying it, because the reason the gravity was bigger is that Jupiter is a Jovian planet. So it snowballs, you know, and it's really hard to say which is the chicken and which is the egg. What one which came first. Yeah?
With present knowledge of the solar system, of course, the two mirroring plates were not going to help a bunch, but present knowledge of the solar system, they're finding the type of clues they need to come up with an origin for the whole works, a plausible kind of, you know, theory for the whole thing.
Are we finding the kinds of clues we need to come up with a plausible theory for the origin of the solar system? Too early to say, I think. I mean, I certainly hope so. It's one of the big reasons we're doing it. And let's put it this way. If we ever manage to figure out how the solar system originated, I think that it's clear that we are not going to be able to do it simply by observing the Earth and by observing other planets remotely from Earth. We are going to have to go to other planets and find out what they're like. And my guess is we're going to have to make a whole lot of landings before and sample returns before we can get very much. I don't think it's going to be easy at all. Because, see, the problem is the origin of the solar system is the origin of the solar system in the sense of the things that revolve around the sun, the planets and the moons and so on, is a minor detail. An accidental side event that happened during the major event, which was the formation of the sun. And so, you know, you're not asking the question of why car A collided with car B, you're asking why did this particular fleck of paint happen to end up there and not there? See what I mean? It's a much more detailed kind of question than just a broad overall process which would be sufficient to explain the origin of the sun. And we're not at all clear on how stars originate yet. So I think it's going to be a long time before we know the origin of the solar system. I don't think it's going to be easy. And I also think the present-day theories of the origin of the solar system make entertaining science fiction, but I don't worry very much about them as reality because we just so very, very much that we don't know. There are lots of other things we know. You know, that happens not to be one of them. And it's a shame that it is one of, that it's not one of them, because to the general public, origins, I think, have an especial interest, you know, and all kinds of fantastic things we learned about the moon, but the origin of the moon is still a big mystery. And I think a lot of the public has never quite forgiven us for that. The reason for it turns out to be that the moon is so much more interesting than we gave it credit for, that it's had quite an involved history of its own, and that history has destroyed the evidence of its origin, you know? So it's not really something to be disappointed about, but I think there are a lot of people, I think there are even a lot of astronomers, let alone general public, who have zero interest in the moon except one possibility as it's serving as the evidence of the origin of the solar system. And they were hoping that it would be as dead and uninteresting as possible, and some of them, they've never forgiven it for not being, but it's not. Well, next chance for something left over, unchanged from the origin of the solar system is Phobos and Deimos. And they're going to be a little hard to get to. And there's another possibility, too, and that is that astronomers have just begun in the last few years to discover a whole flock of asteroids which have orbits across that of the Earth and which are about as easy to get to as the moon in terms, a number of those seem to have carbonaceous chondritic compositions, which is a fancy way of saying they won't change from the origin of the solar system, as far as we can tell from the outside. So that might be useful also. They would also be a very rich source of construction material. Lots of good stuff. I talked a little about space colonization a few weeks ago. Lots of stuff you can't get from the moon because it's not present in very large quantities. For example, petrochemicals. And you could synthesize petrochemicals with very little trouble from carbonaceous chondritic material. As it is now, we're going to have to carry a lot of that stuff from the Earth. It's still a small percentage of the tonnage that you need, but if you're building a space colony big enough to house several million people in real comfort, not in, you know, space station kind of conditions, but a home for the rest of their lives, you got to provide them with certain luxuries, you know, and among those luxuries are things that you can get from carbonaceous chondrite. Yeah, plastics, for example. Any questions? Okay, you are approaching me with fire in your eyes.
You
like me to go home.
Toys.
Okay, all right, fine. Well, it looks as though there aren't any more questions anyway, though, and so let me thank you once again, and I'll see you next week. That you might have, reasonably sure. No? Everybody understood everything I said? All right. Yeah?
A few weeks ago you mentioned that a space colony orbiting Earth would be economic.
Right.
What would be the basis of their economy?
What would be the basis of the economy of a space colony? Well, anything that you can do in space more cheaply than you can do on Earth, or let's say so much more cheaply that it's worth the cost of sending it back to the Earth as well. And one obvious possibility there, and the one that's been given the most study, is energy. It turns out that because the Earth has air and night, and so we have clouds and haze and so forth, even in the desert, and you have atmospheric absorption of the sun when it's low in the sky and that kind of thing, and of course at night you don't have any sunlight at all, about 10 times as much sunlight passes through a square meter of free space at the Earth's distance from the sun as passes through a square meter of Earth's surface. And that factor of 10 turns out to make the difference between solar power being economical and not. And even though you have to build the space colony in order to be able to build the solar energy collectors, and it turns out to be cheaper to do it that way than to build them on the ground and orbit them, put them up into orbit through this enormous gravitational field that we have here. So you get the space colony up there, you get the people and the materials up once. The space colony, remember, is 99.5% built with materials from the moon anyway. So are your solar energy collectors, which are large satellites several miles in diameter, which are then placed in geosynchronous orbit.
and it is cheaper just because the Earth's gravity is so strong and the Moon's gravity is so weak to do all that from space than it is to build them on the Earth's surface and put them up above the atmosphere. And it's estimated that the relatively modest program of space colony development and space manufacturing of these power sets, by the year 2000 we could have solar energy collectors in space supplying an amount of energy equal to the current U.S. usage. Now, of course, that's not what the usage will be then, but it's certainly a big fraction of what the usage will be then. And, of course, it has the very large advantage that, number one, you are not using any of the Earth's resources to do this. Well, 0.5% of your colony is the Earth's resources, otherwise not. And you also have a totally cost-free, as far as resources are concerned, source of energy. You know, the sun is just throwing that energy out into space anyway. If we don't intercept it, it's going to be seen, you know, 20 light years away the next time, and it's non-polluting, you know. It's non-polluting both in the collection and in the transmission. You send it back to the Earth by microwave beams, and the microwave beams are sufficiently dilute that they do not, you know, everybody pictures these microwave beams if something goes wrong with the antenna flying across the landscape, you know, and tracing out a path of destruction as they go, but that's not the way it works at all. If you were standing in the middle of one, it would not be a good idea to build your house in the middle of one, but because a long-term exposure to microwaves is not a good idea. But, you know, if you're standing in the middle of one, you would feel slightly warmer. It's about the same energy density as sunlight. So aside from possible second-order ecological effects, which are still being studied, for example, what happens after 10 generations of birds have been attracted by the warmth of the beams and built their nests in them? See, that kind of thing. That's a question that was actually seriously raised, and nobody knows the answer to that one. They're trying very, very hard to do their ecological homework on this one and answer questions like that ahead of time so that they don't get caught with the second-order ecological effects the way the nuclear people did. The nuclear people demonstrated there's no danger the reactor is going to blow up like an atom bomb and thought that was all they had to do, you know, and then it turned out, well, there's a lot more to it than that. So people are still looking into it, but so far it looks as though it's both economical and ecologically reasonable to collect solar energy. And the first colony, which would cost about $100 billion spread over about 15 years, would pay for itself in about the following 8 years simply from the solar energy. So, you know, that's just one example, probably, but it's the one that's been given the most thinking so far. A book by Gerard O'Neill, who's the originator of this idea, at least in its modern form, called The High Frontier, has just been published, and I'm told it's now for sale in at least one bookstore. My own copy is on order from the L5 Society, and they haven't got around to sending it to me yet, so I haven't seen it, but I know it's a good book. Sir?
Yeah, how is that converted into reusable
on the Earth?
Yeah.
You have a big antenna farm out in the desert somewhere, a couple miles in diameter, and you simply collect a microwave.